Good morning, Your Honors. Monica Wiener of Munger, Tolles & Olson on behalf of the appellants, who, for purposes of convenience, I'll be referring to this morning collectively as OCZIF. I will be arguing this morning in place of Mark Schinderman, who unfortunately had another conflict this morning.
Thank you. Could I ask you to spell your name for me, please?
Yes. It's W-I-E-N-E-R. First name is Monica, M-O-N-I-K-A.
Thank you, Ms. Wiener.
Your Honor, at this time I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you. The issue before the Court this morning is whether the Bankruptcy Court abused its discretion when it approved a settlement between the debtor Sunworld and its insider and parent, Cadiz. Well, let's start with the hard part. This Court reviews that decision for an abuse of discretion. But this Court has held that it is an abuse of discretion for the Bankruptcy Court to approve a settlement where there's an insufficient factual basis to support the conclusion that that settlement was fair and reasonable under the circumstances in that case. Now, that is the standard in any case, any settlement that is approved by the Bankruptcy Court. Here we had circumstances that include an insider transaction between a parent and subsidiary. And under those circumstances, the Supreme Court requires an additional level of more rigorous scrutiny to ensure that the settlement is fair. Now, what does that mean here? It seems to us, Your Honors, that there would need to be some kind of independent, disinterested review, such as the sort of review that the Creditors Committee initially requested to make here. In fact, the Creditors Committee had requested to make an independent evaluation of these claims. But that didn't happen here. At the very least, the standard requires, and this Court has held that, it requires a rigorous and independent review, an informed and independent review, resulting in an informed and independent judgment by the Bankruptcy Court. That didn't happen here either. The Court glossed over a number of important legal theories, important defenses that the debtor may have had to these claims, and in addition, affirmative counterclaims that the debtor may have been able to bring against Cadiz.
Some of the creditors did like the deal, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Not as such, but as part of an overall kind of deal that was being made. So that some of the creditors, I guess a lot of the creditors, really thought it was okay, right?
Well, Your Honor,
I know that you believe once they thought that they weren't disinterested anymore. But the point is.
That's correct.
But the point, I understand that. But the point is, they did think that. A lot of them thought, this is a pretty cool deal. At the end of the day, we like this, right?
Well, perhaps. I'm not sure whether Your Honor is referring specifically to the note holders. I'm not sure whether Your Honor is referring specifically to the note holders. Or the trade creditors, but those were two constituencies that did ultimately come down in favor of or approve or withdraw their not the note holders were actually part of the settlement, but the trade creditors did in fact, and the creditors committee as the representative, the trade creditors constituted a majority of that committee, did in fact withdraw their objection to the settlement.
So the two directly involved parties, for whatever it's worth, thought it was a good deal. A large number of creditors thought it was a good deal.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
But none of those people really reviewed it independently, only so we shouldn't consider what they thought, right? That's what you said a moment ago.
I'm not sure that it's fair to say that they thought it was a good deal. Perhaps the note holders thought it was a good deal because they were getting essentially.
They didn't object, I guess, would be.
Correct. They did not ultimately object. But the withdrawal of their objection was based on a side deal, essentially, that was cut at the last
minute
with the trade creditors, who were a majority, a voting majority of the committee.
Sure. And this was a sine qua non to getting the other piece to work. It was sort of working. Join it. By the way, has that been approved, or is that all held up? Just curious.
I'm sorry. The
the overarching one. This was a piece of an overarching.
Correct. As far as we know, Mr. Bogdanoff can probably speak to this more directly. But The plan has not yet been confirmed, and as I understand it, there's not currently a date on calendar for confirmation of the plan. The overarching global settlement that this piece was a part of, the settlement as between the note holders and Cadiz and the debtor, I believe the terms of it were that it would go forward, provided that the settlement was within a certain range, and it did fall within that range.
Well, why don't you tell me how, because you were an unsecured creditor, correct?
Correct.
Why don't you tell me how Oz would benefit from the court's rejection of the bankruptcy court's approval of this initial settlement?
Well, essentially, Your Honor, we don't know. I think it's fair to say.
Well, you wouldn't object if you didn't know something.
Our objection is based on principally what we don't know, but also what we do know. And from what we do know, it appears to us that the settlement wasn't fair. So to the extent that a fuller investigation is made.
Okay, but fair is not a standard that we look at. We're looking at abuse of discretion. So
that's correct, Your Honor. However, I do think that within that standard, abuse of discretion, and this is what I was referring to in the beginning, it is an abuse of discretion. This Court has clearly held to approve a settlement agreement where there is an insufficient factual basis to find that the settlement was fair. It begins to sound a little bit circular, but there
well,
is...
Well, because if you define fair as getting all your money, generally in this type of situation, no one's going to get all their money, right?
That's absolutely true.
We wouldn't be in bankruptcy court.
Correct. It becomes a question of how much of the pie Cadiz's claim ought to be taking up, I suppose. The settlement.
There must be some if you're objecting to it, there's some reason you think you would be better off if the court hadn't approved this, and what tell me what that is.
We believe that, based on what we've seen, Your Honor, we believe that it may not have been fair. We believe it was most likely not fair. That
you know that's you know, the sort of standing back and saying no fair doesn't quite do it. You mean you're just sort of a disinterested parties who just think, well, we like things to be fair, and we're not sure this is fair, but we don't expect to gain anything, and we don't know what we would gain. We might actually lose. The bankruptcy judge thought, you know, if you guys manage to throw a monkey wrench into this deal, what might happen is that everything will collapse into a mess, and Sun won't get out, and neither will Cadiz. Everybody will collapse into a great filthy mess, and that's what a lot of the creditors apparently thought, and note holders thought. And you say, no fair. And I think it's a fair question to say, when you say no fair, what ain't fair about it? Who's getting hurt? Why are you being hurt? Is anybody being hurt? Is everybody being benefited? But you just say no fair. I mean, that's what you're saying to us, that somehow that doesn't quite get there.
The debtor threw out a lot of hypotheticals in connection with why this settlement ought to be approved, why it ought to be approved quickly, in terms of what would happen between itself and Cadiz, and specifically what would happen to Cadiz if the settlement wasn't approved. Those are all hypotheticals, but this much we do know. We know that Cadiz had asserted claims, which the debtor estimated at $17.5 million against the estate. So those claims were going to take up that portion of the amount that was available, that pro rata distribution that would be available to unsecured creditors. The settlement, the currency of the settlement in this case, was in terms of the allowed amount of Cadiz's claim. We know that the debtor was starting with $17.5 million in that regard. To the extent that that amount should have been less, and ultimately the settlement was $13.5 million, and we think it probably should have been substantially less than that, that increases the amount that would have been available for other unsecured creditors, such as OSIF.
But so even though a secured creditor is getting, what, $4 million less? You're saying they should have gotten $6 million less, and that would leave $2 million more that might give you a chance of getting some money?
Correct.
I mean, because obviously you're on the bottom of the food chain as an unsecured creditor any way that you look at it. So that's your thinking that you're even – there's going to be less of a pot of gold, as it – if you – or less of a pot to get from if with this approval, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And essentially, in the weird world of bankruptcy, that's it's a little bit dog-eat-dog.
Remind me, how much are you owed?
I'm sorry?
How much are you owed?
We are owed $5 million, approximately.
Okay, and the bankruptcy judge says, what I really think will happen if this doesn't go through is that everything will collapse into a big mess. And maybe, you know, after years of litigation with Cadiz, the note holders will have foreclosed, all kinds of horrible things will have happened, and there won't be anything left at the end. And here at least there's some chance that something will be left. That's what the bankruptcy judge seems to have said, something like that.
I think that's a fair characterization. First of all, I would note Cadiz was not in bankruptcy. What was before the court was not necessarily the fate of Cadiz, but of Sunworld.
But the court's saying, obviously, if the whole thing falls into the bucket, it's just going to cause a lot of harm, and there won't be anything coming back. There won't even be the 13.5 assignment for the note holders.
I think what was missing here was a real link between this parade of horribles that was going to happen if the settlement was not approved and the need to approve the settlement so quickly. And in fact, it appears that circumstances have not really borne out all of these fears that the debtor had about getting itself out of bankruptcy post haste.
That's not the test for abuse of discretion, though, is it?
I'm sorry, what is not the test?
I said that is not the test for abuse of discretion in approving the deal, is it?
No, Your Honor, the test is, was the settlement fair? Absolutely.
From the front end, did he abuse his discretion when he said, I see all these problems?
But at that point, Your Honor, the problems were hypothetical, and they were stated in a fairly general way, that you're going to have gigantic interestate battles that are going to bog down both estates. Well, that has not materialized. That had this settlement not been approved, I'm not sure we would be in a much different position.
How would it materialize? I mean, the point was they're not having a big chunk of litigation. So, of course, it hasn't materialized yet. If you're successful, maybe it will. But of course, the future is always hypothetical, is it not?
That is absolutely true.
Okay.
However, I think that the key here is, once again, Cadiz was not in bankruptcy, and the debtor makes it very clear in its motion that was one of the real goals here, was to keep Cadiz out of bankruptcy. Well, the court was not concerned with the fate of Cadiz, and there are two sides, really, to the coin that the court needed to weigh and that the debtor needed to weigh: the probable success, the probability of success in the litigation, that at the end of the day, Sunworld, not Cadiz, Sunworld in and of itself and Sunworld's creditors would wind up better off had this litigation gone forward, or at least had they pursued a more thorough and independent evaluation of these claims. And that side of the coin was really only addressed in the most general terms. There were substantial defenses that to these claims that the debtor simply didn't address. And the other side of the coin is the complexity, the duration of the litigation. Again, that was addressed really in the most general terms, that any preference case is going to be difficult to prove, that, for example, I believe the court stated simply equitable subordination is a disfavored remedy. But without really linking those two sides, what's the upside versus what's the downside, we know that the court believed, and the debtor asserted, that this would have been a long and drawn-out process to litigate these claims. That would be true. But there was a huge potential upside, particularly as to some of the affirmative counterclaims that the debtor missed or did not address adequately, simply glossed over, such as equitable subordination and recharacterization, those claims could have reduced Cadiz's claim to zero. And on the side of defenses that the debtor may have had to these claims, there really was no analysis at all. There really was the simple taking of at face value of Cadiz's asserted claims.
I don't know. We're dealing with a pretty knowledgeable about this case and experienced and perspicacious bankruptcy judge. In fact, if I recall the transcript, he's asking Oz's counsel a number of times. He says, well, you know, are you aware of this particular problem or the cases that deal with this particular problem of showing insolvency or et cetera? And counsel says, no, I'm not aware of those. And the judge says, let me tell you about some of the problems from some of the cases I've seen. And that goes off a couple of different times. So the judge isn't stupid about what the problems are, and he's not stupid about what the upsides and downsides are, at least not from the transcript, he doesn't appear to be. It's kind of hard to see how we say, well, you just didn't know what was going on, Judge.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The judge, I'm sure, has seen many more preference cases than I myself have, and could make generalizations based on those cases at a very high level and probably in quite accurately. The point is, generalizations aren't good enough here. We needed to move beyond those generalizations that, well, okay, in this context of preference litigation or equitable subordination or whichever claim was being addressed, this would be a long and drawn-out and difficult litigation process. That's true of a lot of different kinds of claims. But again, you have to look at the flip side. You have to look at what the probable outcome might have been and what the benefits could have been had that litigation succeeded.
You mentioned you wanted to reserve a couple of minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. Lee Bogdanoff, a member of Cletouche and Bogdanoff and Stern, I'm appearing on behalf of the appellees, the Sunworld Estates. The question, I think, as Your Honors have indicated here, is whether an abuse of discretion occurred. And that test, in turn, requires a showing, I think, that Judge Nagel clearly exercised a bad judgment in approving this settlement.
What about the sufficiency of the findings?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that was addressed in the ANC Properties case. In ANC Properties, and virtually the identical contention was made here, was that the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the judge just recited his consideration of the four factors. And following, you know, well-established principles, this Court held that so long as the record fairly supports the Court's conclusions, and it's clear that the four factors were presented to the Court, then there is no abuse of discretion if the Court does not make specific enunciations as to these aspects. I should also point out, as one of you did, it is exceedingly clear that Judge Nagel was actively engaged. He formed conclusions and opinions regarding the matters that were in front of him, including counsel devoted her attention almost exclusively to the resolution of the litigation claims and the claims. It's very clear that Judge Nagel was mindful and aware of this Court's rulings and the governing case law. So I think there is sufficient evidence, sufficient record to establish that it was all there in front of him and that there was no abuse of discretion. I should also point out that the record here was exceedingly lengthy. We filed a detailed memorandum of the law. It was 35 pages, which is the maximum that we were entitled to file. We submitted documents, transfer records, each and every transfer from Sunworld and Cadiz and vice versa over the prior 3 years preceding the petition was in front of the judge. We submitted two affidavits. There was additionally 2 full days of depositions. There was discovery, propounded by OXIF going back from 1999. I should also point out that we filed this motion 9 months into the case, not on the first day of the case, and there was ample opportunity through Rule 2004 and otherwise for parties to conduct a discovery and to investigate the bona fides of these causes of action. And I think the other point that I'd like to make at the outset, Judge Anderson in his memorandum opinion affirming, and clearly Judge Naugle understood that this settlement was not just about the resolution of claims, but rather it was the finalization of a financial divorce between Cady's and Sun World, under which the various contracts between the two organizations were rejected. As well, Cady's agreed to waive and relinquish any effort to attempt to recover on its equity in Sun World. That was in the settlement agreement and was of benefit. Going to the so-called parade of horribles, I think it is clear that there would have been a great filthy mess, as Your Honor indicated, had this settlement not been approved. There was evidence in front of Judge Naugle that was submitted by Cady's, a publicly held company, that it was the subject of an imminent foreclosure, that its creditor, its secured creditor, in all probability, would proceed with that foreclosure, and that would result in a bankruptcy case, in all probability, because of the low numbering rules, to be filed in front of Judge Naugle. There was a significant overlap in the creditor claims between the two entities. And those of us that have lived through warring bankruptcy estates, cases in which two estates go at it hammer and tong, had no appetite for that outcome. The evidence in front of the judge, this wasn't just Judge Naugle's conclusions, and he wasn't basing it solely on a pleading filed by Cady's. Sun World's independent director, Mr. Beek, as well as his chief financial officer, both testified in declaration and in great detail in deposition of their concerns regarding a Cady's bankruptcy and the prospect that it would result in a mess between the two entities. And Judge Naugle clearly got it. He made findings about it. I think his very final comment in ruling on the motion was the possibility that Cady's and Sun World had the ability to kill one another. He talked about rearranging the deck on the Titanic. He didn't just make that stuff up. He clearly read and understood the evidence and the presentation as to what was at risk.
One of the points, if I gathered it, was that this was supposed to be really a piece of a puzzle, and the overall puzzle was an agreement, a different agreement with others. I'll ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. Has that happened?
Well,
or is it happening, or what's going on?
Let me tell you what happened. As a result of the Judge Naugle's approval of the settlement, the transfer of the claim, of the Cady's claim, to the note holders occurred in the middle of December. And the waiver by the note holders that participated in that settlement of their right to pursue Cady's occurred. As a result, Cady's effectuated its restructuring and its recapitalization and has gone on its way. With respect to Sun World, we went ahead and filed a plan of reorganization premised upon this deal and the good feelings that existed between the note holders who were cooperating and negotiated this agreement with us. It so happens that the note holders have engaged in protracted negotiations concerning the terms of the plan of reorganization that we subsequently filed.
Okay.
They were unable to reach agreement, and we are currently heavily involved in a merger and acquisition process. We are accessing the marketplace, look for acquirers or investors with a view toward effectuating a transaction either next month or early next year. So the agreement that was in front of the judge has been implemented, and it has worked by its terms, and we think it was appropriate on the circumstances presented and in retrospect. The bigger picture, that is, our efforts to get out of bankruptcy have stalled, and that's where we are.
Well, part of what the judge was told was that I believe some of the creditors, the trade creditors, were not objecting or withdrawn objection because part of the deal was somewhere in the background, they were going to get taken care of to some extent, and they would continue to advance credit.
Yeah. What happened, Your Honor, by the way,
has that fallen in place, or is that gone?
Well, that is subject to, it will be in place. When the plan is confirmed, that aspect of the settlement will be implemented. What happened was the creditors' committee.
Have they fallen off that wagon, or are they still on?
No, they have not fallen off that wagon. That promise that was made by the note holders on the record at the outset of the hearing, with full disclosure to the parties between the official creditors' committee and the note holders, remains in place. But that's a deal to be put together in the event a planned transaction or sale occurs, and when that happens, that will occur.
It wasn't clear in speaking to opposing counsel. The pain that Oz is likely to get out of that is that they're not going to be part of the trade creditors, because I guess they're not a trade creditor as such. They're some kind of a lending institution, I take it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think
and,
that's...
And that's why they will be... Why a lot of the creditors might think this is great, because we want this thing to stay in business and keep going, and they'll pay us something and we'll keep advancing trade credit and blah, blah, blah. But from Oz's standpoint, that's no big deal. Is that where we're at?
I don't know, and obviously they can speak for themselves.
They can speak for themselves.
They attempted.
They didn't. So I'm trying to get a picture.
Well, you know, I think they played the role of the squeaky wheel. The fact of the matter is that OXIF was a member and was at the time a member of the creditors committee. The creditors committee, official creditors committee, did two things in connection with this settlement, I guess three. First, they filed an objection. Secondly, they engaged in negotiations. The negotiations did two things. First, we and the note holders agreed that the allowed claim in favor of Katie's would not be $15 million, as we originally requested Judge Noggle to approve, but rather would be $13.5 million. That was negotiated by the creditors' committee, read onto the record, and on that basis, the creditors' committee withdrew its objection in its entirety. That resolution certainly redounded to the benefit of OXIF as an unsecured creditor, because it reduced the amount of claims that they would be competing with. The Katie's claim is pari passu with OXIF. It's a general unsecured non-priority claim. That benefited OXIF. Additionally, there was an agreement which was read onto the record. We did not request Judge Noggle to approve it, but we wanted to make sure he understood it, and there nobody could ever accuse us of hiding the ball, under which the note holders agreed that in connection with a plan of reorganization or a disposition of the company's assets supported by them, they would support a provision under which trade vendors that agreed to furnish credit to Sunworld or its successor following the emergence from bankruptcy would receive payment over time. Now, because OXIF is, I guess, a hedge fund, it's not a trade creditor, it's not in the business of furnishing goods or services, it does not directly benefit from that. Certainly, to effectuate that provision, we didn't ask Judge Noggle to approve it, but to effectuate it, we would have to meet certain hurdles and requirements under the bankruptcy code, including if OXIF were a dissenting member or was part of
it. So what you're saying, Oz doesn't have the same sort of leverage that the trade vendors do, because the trade vendors are essential for Sun to continue doing what it's doing.
Welcome to Chapter 11. Yeah, exactly. The trade vendors have the ability to confer consideration going forward for the benefit of the estate, and the estate is to be distributed in accordance with the priority scheme, and to the extent there is a benefit.
But that's a fact whether this is approved or not approved, right? I mean, that's just the reality of what Oz does, and that's the reality of what the trade vendors do relative to Sun.
Yeah, I suppose OXIF could always trade places with and go into that business, but they've chosen not to. Your Honor, with respect to the statements about this being an insider settlement, as I indicated, the case law, not in this circuit, but there are cases at the bankruptcy level and even the appellate level that hold that a stricter scrutiny of a settlement involving an insider is not warranted, where creditors either participated in the settlement or supported the settlement. And here, as I indicated, the official representative of unsecured creditors withdrew its objection in its entirety. and participated in the settlement. There was a modification to the settlement, as I indicated. Likewise, the note holders participated in the settlement. They were, the evidence was before Judge Noggle that they held approximately 90% of the claims. There was a strong suspicion and belief, which probably is going to prove legitimate, that they were not only the largest secured creditors, but the largest unsecured creditors. And they certainly had every incentive at the outset of the case to go after KDE's Hammer and Tong, because they would be the primary beneficiaries of those efforts. So there was significant creditor involvement. I should also point out that Sun World's independent director, Mr. Barton Beek, who was not a member of the KDE's board, he did have some grossly out-of-the-money options at the KDE's level, but I think he clearly was independent, testified in support of the settlement, testified for a day in deposition, and I think gave some compelling testimony. Now, he wasn't a bankruptcy expert. He's a wonderful person and a great lawyer. He's not a bankruptcy lawyer, so he certainly had to rely upon my firm and our work and our analysis, and he certainly testified that he did, and the case law indicates that that's appropriate. I think it's also completely unfair to suggest that we glossed over and accepted at face value the claims that the Sun World estate could assert against KDE's and the claims that KDE's was asserting against Sun World. There was an extraordinarily detailed analysis of the preference statute, the preference claims, and the preference defenses, three independent defenses that we believed KDE's could and would raise, one of which the appellant has not sought to revisit on appeal, that is the new value defense, which dramatically reduces the preference exposure. There were two other defenses that we believed gave a high probability of success in favor of KDE's with respect to the assertion of preferences. And more fundamentally, the record, the evidence showed that in the year preceding Sun World's bankruptcy, KDE's advanced more than $3 million into Sun World than it took out. And the preference statute, fundamentally, there is a lot of game theory that you have to go through to apply the defenses, but fundamentally it's designed to address an improvement in position. This creditor didn't improve its position. It worsened its position in the year preceding bankruptcy. And what that means is that while Sun World might have been able to thread a needle and establish that certain defenses were not applicable, fundamentally, we think that would be an extraordinarily difficult road to hoe. And in fact, the analysis was very detailed. Judge Noggle clearly was aware of this Court's opinions, this Court's rulings in connection with ordinary course and solvency in the farming area. With respect to the other potential claims that counsel referenced, the record, quite simply, there was nothing in the record. There's nothing in the record to suggest any fraud, oppression, overreaching by KDE's for its benefit at the expense of Sun World. As I indicated, there was discovery that was done over a three-year horizon. Transfer records were provided. Documents were provided. There was nothing there. There was no case for equitable subordination. It just wasn't there. If it had been, we would have had an obligation to discuss it and analyze it. It would have been frivolous. And the law, I think, is crystal clear that a settlement motion need not speculate. It must canvass the pertinent issues, the pertinent causes of action, the pertinent considerations, not every conceivable cause of action and consideration. There simply was nothing to support an alter ego cause of action. And when it was raised for the first time in oral argument, my response was, I was just completely taken aback that anyone on behalf of the Sun World estate would want to try to pierce the corporate veil to get to KDE's, because in my experience, that's a two-way street. That wouldn't have been a very smart thing to do. So there really weren't any other cause of action that we thought that made any sense, that required any analysis, and certainly that we would want to pursue. With respect to the cost of litigation, I think OCSIF's own efforts here showed, this wasn't a mini trial, but there was certainly a lot of analysis of the cause of action. It would have been very clear that the Sun World of the state would have expended a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to pursue what we really believed were causes of action that weren't going to lead us anywhere. And with respect to the KDE's claims, it's just simply untrue to say that we accepted them at face value. But even if we did, we didn't. The question before this Court and before the Bankruptcy Court was not whether Cady's had valid claims, had a valid rejection claim. The Walsh Construction case at 669 F. 2nd, 1325, this Court said that the question with respect to the resolution of disputed claims is not whether those claims are valid or invalid, but whether, quote, the outcome of the claims litigation is doubtful. This Court also spoke about whether the claims were not clearly invalid as a matter of law or had a, and had a substantial basis. And I think the record, a fair evaluation of the record shows that the claims that we evaluated and analyzed that we believed Cady's would pursue, they had filed them, that there was a probability that a substantial portion of them would be resolved. And we decided in cooperation with a whole lot of creditors to go ahead and try to resolve them. And we did so, we believe, in terms that were fair and beneficial to all creditors, all unsecured creditors, and to the estate. And while the appellant disagreed with that conclusion, we think just about everybody came to the opposite conclusion, and we believe this was a beneficial settlement for OCSIF. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Weiner. We've got 2 minutes and change.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the insider issue once again. I don't think that we heard anything from counsel that indicates why, even if there was going to be this parade of horribles, it would be sufficient not to have a truly disinterested review of the settlement. Counsel has told us, and Your Honor has asked some questions regarding what would have been the outcome and wasn't this really better for everyone at the end of the day. Well, if that's true, any time you have a settlement between an insider and a parent, do we just throw that more rigorous scrutiny out the window and assume that a parade of interstate litigation and horribles can be avoided? That doesn't seem like a fair standard. Here, counsel also mentioned the two individuals, Mr. Spear and Mr. Beek, that were primarily responsible for reviewing this settlement on behalf of the debtor. First of all, there was no testimony by these individuals in the record. The bankruptcy court never had an opportunity to address their credibility or assess their credibility. Both of these individuals had inherent conflicts of interest that prevented them from performing the kind of disinterested review that was required here, from rigorously scrutinizing the settlement in the way that a truly disinterested party would have done. And we suggested in our briefs a number of possible defenses and counterclaims that a truly disinterested party would have focused in on. For example, 502b4, very significant. The debtor has now said it's doubtful, perhaps, whether that would have reduced the claim. It doesn't appear all that doubtful to us, particularly in light of the fact that the debtor itself admitted that it believed it was being overcharged under the services agreement. It itself believed that it could have obtained those services at lower cost elsewhere. Seems to us that that in and of itself constitutes some evidence or at least a very large red flag that this is something that a truly disinterested party would have looked into, had a duty to look into, in fact, in terms of reducing Cady's claims and not simply accepting them at face value. Counsel also mentioned some authority to the effect that the involvement of a disinterested creditor or an outside party in negotiating a settlement somehow cures the need or removes the need for more rigorous scrutiny. Well, the cases cited by counsel deal with a situation where you did have a truly disinterested party or a party who really had an incentive to rigorously review the settlement. Here, as we mentioned, the note holders did not have that incentive. They were on both sides of the transaction. They were going to essentially inherit the Cady's claim. So they had an incentive for that claim to be as large as possible.
Thank you very much. And thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted. 0273613, Toison. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Toison versus Ashcroft. Each side will have 10 minutes on this case.